You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Let's head down Pico Boulevard all the way to the beach in Santa Monica, where you'll find Casa Del Mar. These days, it's a luxury hotel, but back in the 60s and 70s, it was the headquarters and dormitory for Synanon. That's a drug rehab program that had turned into a cult. Members shaved their heads. Deserters were called splittees. They were hunted down and beaten. When Synanon was successfully sued, the cult's leader, Chuck Diederich, ordered the opposing lawyer killed by having a rattlesnake put in his mailbox. That lawyer survived. Mikel Jolet also survived. He's the lead singer of the LA band Airborne Toxic Event. He was a young child at the time. His dad was addicted to drugs. Both his parents had joined Synanon, and they lived at the Casa Del Mar. But Diederich had ordered all children separated from their parents to be brought up communally. So Jolet and his older brother Tony lived in what was essentially an orphanage. They only got to see their parents on occasional visits. In a new memoir, Jolet writes about the effect of that early upbringing, about his life since, too. The book is called Hollywood Park, and it's accompanied by an Airborne Toxic Event album by the same name.
For 15 years I live in a room with my heart on my sleeve and my throat dry from hearing the words. You can change, you can change if you're ready to try.
That's the title track from the new album, and Mikel Jolet joins me right now. Mikel, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve. That was quite an intro.
Dude, it's quite a book.
Oh, thank you.
The book is called, and the album too, by the way, called Hollywood Park. When I first saw it, I was like, oh, Hollywood Park. It's a book about the horse track. And it kind of is, right?
Yeah, it's partially about the horse track. My dad was a big handicapper, and he used to go to Hollywood Park in Inglewood every Saturday before they tore it down. And a lot of my childhood happened there. It sort of was kind of a place where the men went. I think that's kind of how I thought of it at the time when I was a kid, you know, because we were far away.
It's the horses ran wild through the town at Hollywood Park.
You were far away. You were growing up in Northern California or in Oregon, right? And then you would come and spend summers with your dad and Bonnie, whom he met at Synanon, not your mother, but another woman that he had met, right?
Right. She was my caretaker at the orphanage. She was really great. She was, you know, she treated me like a son, I think. You know, one of the things about living in Synanon, we were told that, you know, we didn't have parents, or we kind of knew what a mom, like we knew the word mom, we knew the word dad, but we didn't, the words didn't have any particular meaning. To us, they were these people that would come and visit, and then they'd leave. You know, we'd see them maybe for a couple hours every few weeks, or, you know, when we escaped, when we left, one day this woman showed up, you know, said she was my mother and took us away. And, you know, it was weird. We were like, are we allowed to do this? And I tried to write the book from that perspective. There was a lot of confusion around, you know, that era in my life. So I tried to capture that in the book, that you know, to just let these sort of lies and the confusion and all the different perspectives be what drives the story, so that would then capture kind of the psychological, emotional reality of what it felt like to be a small child going through all these things.
How old were you when you got out, when you escaped with your mom and your brother?
I was just about four.
Four.
And my brother was just about seven, which meant we'd spent all those years in the orphanage.
Wow. Like I mentioned, escaping could be dangerous. You witnessed somebody who did get out, who was beaten in your driveway. You saw this happen as a young child.
Yeah. So our roommate was a man named Phil, and he was a good guy. He was a nice man, and he was kind of like a father figure for a little bit, just warm and kind. And yeah, he came home one day, and we were always told, you know, you can't go outside or else the bad men are going to get you, you know, after we left. And they were going around, they were beating people up. Chuck, who was the leader, he had this goon squad, which was basically just a bunch of thugs, but he called them the Imperial Marines. So they came and they had, Phil came home, he got out of his VW bus, like any good hippie, he had a VW bus. And these two men approached with masks on. I didn't really know what they were. There's kind of these flesh-colored things. And now I know that, oh, it's like how bank robbers do nylon. And they had these skinny black clubs And he sort of smiled at me. He didn't see him. And then I didn't know what to say. And then they just started beating on him. And he fell over. And he was screaming in the driveway. And our eyes locked for a minute, Phil and I. And they beat him unconscious, nearly to death. And they, you know, he almost died. He spent a month in the hospital. He was in a coma. He ended up getting meningitis. It was really bad. Mm.
And your mom, she denied that you were even there and saw the beating, right? She said, no, you weren't there. You were somewhere else. I mean, you didn't see anything happen.
Yeah.
To a kid, that's got to be, like, so confusing.
Yeah, it's weird. It was weird. There was sort of this, like, two realities. You know, one was the thing that you witness and you're part of. And this happened a lot of times when I was growing up, many times, that she forgot or invented a new reality. And I later sort of went to therapy and I started writing the book and everything. You know, I recognize that this is very, very common in children with, you know, in a emotionally abusive or abusive homes. Very common with people with a certain type of mental illness, and that these sorts of things weren't just for me. This is something that happens quite a bit.
Talk about your mom. She, you mentioned, and later in the book you talk about her experiences and obviously the things that she was going through. And was she diagnosed as having depression and narcissistic,
yeah.
What is it?
She wasn't diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder or borderline personality disorder. That's more me and my shrink trying to figure out. She has been diagnosed for crippling depression, chronic. You know, we have a language as a society about schizophrenia. We have a language about depression. We have a language about alcoholism. But we don't really have a language around these disorders that create certain types of relationships, and they tend to lack empathy. They tend to involve a lot of falsehood. They tend to be very, very self-focused. It was like a eureka moment to discover these things. And it's hard to talk about publicly. I just want to acknowledge that too, because there's a part of me that also can't help but feel protective of her. And see how much tragedy she had to deal with in her life. She left the cult penniless, without a friend, with her two kids who were both traumatized. You know, she'd gone through a divorce with her husband. I think growing up, her mom was a severe alcoholic as well. And I think she really tried to escape her demons. I really think she did. I just think it didn't work. And in writing the book, I had to reconstruct sort of my own story. And I really wanted the book to be real and honest.
You talk to her still?
No, we've been you know, semi-estranged since I was about 19. And then we haven't talked at all in the last handful of years.
When your dad died, which we'll talk more about later, you called her and you were seeking comfort. And she really didn't give it to you, did she?
We're just going for the big guns.
your well, book is, I read it and I'm just like, oh my God, there's so much there. And if anything, if you don't want to talk about any of it, you don't have
to. No, let's talk about it. It's fine. No, it's fine. It's fine. I appreciate that. It was hard. My father and I were very close. And there was this moment, when I was just broken down. I was driving to the hospital. He died at Cedars, and I was driving to Cedars, and I had to fill out all that really horrible death paperwork that you have to do when people die. And I thought, well, you know what? I'll just try calling her. It's been so many years since I've opened up to her. I was so angry at her for so many years. You know, this, just try this simple bit of parenting, you know, a son grieving the loss of his father. And, you know, I called her, I'm sputtering, crying, you know, whatever. And I said, you know, I lost my dad. I'm in so much pain. And I just expected to hear, you know, it's okay. I love you. You know, just basic parenting stuff. And then what she said was, it always hurt her that I was so close with him, not with her. You know, and that she didn't understand how I could do that to her. And I feel like it's hard to understand this without the context of the book, you know, and maybe that's part of why I'm a little reticent to talk about it like this, because it, without seeing sort of the context of those remarks, they don't maybe make a lot of sense. But if you see the whole story, I think they make a lot more sense. And basically, I knew there was a disorder at work. You know, I know that NPD, BPD, the people are just unable to see the world outside of their own sort of reflection. That's the nature of these disorders. And they were always kind of murky, and they took a long time for me to understand what it was. And at that moment, it became really clear to me. I was like, oh, I've been reaching out to her. I've had empathy for her. She just hasn't had it for me.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess my hope was in just writing the book so honestly about these things that maybe other people who've experienced these kinds of situations or these sorts of relationships, particularly with parents, might look at it and begin to form a language around it and an understanding of it. Because I think that, you know, they're fairly common disorders.
She moved you to Salem, Oregon, right? And you were raising rabbits to be sort of, you know, off the grid, to make your own food, right?
Right. That was the idea. I think we're also just very poor. We were living on, you know, government cheese and government assistance. And so it was like a way to try to get more food. So, you know, we had these rabbits that we raised, and I learned to slaughter rabbits when I was 7. And they were, of course, living creatures in the real world. You know, we slaughtered and ate them, but they were also these symbols of these smothered and beaten, left in the dark children that we felt like we were. And so it was exciting to write about them, you know. One, to just know there was an ache of like not wanting to kill an animal when you're 7. You don't want to kill your dinner. And then the other, to understand that part of this ache was I identified with the bunny. And so that was me at 8 years old or 7 years old. That was the idea of metaphor already taking shape in my imagination, as it does with all children. And so I thought it would better capture the journey as I went through it, as it actually felt.
Well, part of that journey was deciding to run away from home, which is the inspiration for the first single from the album, which is called Come On Out.
Black lungs, headlines, heading off to the city tonight. Out the front door, turn right, I was alone, all right, all right, all right.
I had a series of stepfathers. The first one was a good man, but he had disappeared. He was just a severe alcoholic, and he disappeared or died, and we weren't really sure which. And then my second stepfather moved in, and he wasn't really that great a guy. I don't know how she put it, but he left us a bunch of times, and he would stand over me and try to intimidate me. And I guess I mouthed off to my mom one night, and he pinned me down and he beat on me, and then I got up and she intervened, to her credit. She, you know, she didn't want him to beat me up, I guess. And so I got on my bike and I rode away, and rode through traffic, you know, just going towards the West Salem Bridge. And it was just like, I guess some of it's just like the righteous anger of children, you know, the feeling like as children we are so much under the control of people who may not have our best interests at heart, you know, and that we really have to live our lives beneath that power. And it's very, very frustrating. And so the song is, part of it's, you know, come on out with it. That's the thing they're yelling at me at the end, like, because they think I've been drinking or stealing cigarettes or, you know, whatever it is that I used to do because I was a little troublemaker. And then some of it's like the idea of come on out. It's like, come on out of the house. Come on out of that house. Come on out into the world. Come on out into the night. Don't just stay in this house and believe what people were telling you. Come on out into the world with the rest of us.
She said, come on out with it. 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 Come on out with it.
In the book, you mentioned Robert Smith, who's the lead singer of The Cure. He was a big influence on your music, right?
I had this friend, and I was over at his house one day, and he put on this record, and it just sounded like the guitars were underwater, and the singer had this strange howling warble, and it was weird. And it, of course, it was The Head on the Door by The Cure. We were just a couple white trash kids in the rain in Oregon, and here was this whole other world, you know, where people thought about things and had sarcasm and irony, and they were smart, and they also felt messed up, and they were kind of okay with feeling messed up, and that's how we felt.
Yesterday I got so old, it made me want to cry. Go on, just walk away. Go on, your choice is made. Go on, and disappear. Go on, away from here.
You eventually went to Stanford. You eventually became a music journalist. You eventually interviewed David Bowie, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. That was a great one. David Bowie was just such a, he was an idol for me growing up. We worshiped David Bowie. My friend Jake and I and a few other guys, we did the haircuts, we did the poses, all the stuff. So I was a terrible music journalist because I was a songwriter on the side, and I was just, all I ever did was ask my idols. I met Tom Waits, I met Lou Reed, you know, Stephen Malcolm. Yeah. Different, and all I ever asked them was like, how do you write this song? How'd you write this song? Oh, where'd you get to, what happened in the bridge here? What was going on there? And so I ended up doing that with David Bowie, and I asked him about songwriting, and he gave me some great advice. And then we had this moment, we were talking about the 60s and the 70s and how it's like the lack of belief in God and how it's like so hard to believe in anything. And at one point we had this really paternal moment, and he kind of looked at me and he said, wait, are you saying, is it hard for people of your generation to really believe in anything? And I was like, dude, I was born in a cult. I was raised in an orphanage. Like, what are you asking me right now? Do I believe in the dream of the 60s? No. The dream of the 60s was like a nightmare for us. What do you? And he was, you know, and he just kind of looked at me. He's like, yeah, the contradiction really messes you guys up, doesn't it? I was like, yeah, David, you understand me. But it was great. And I met Robert Smith as well. It was just like to meet your idols and be able to ask them questions. It was great. It was wonderful. It was a great job.
So you scrapped that and then you became a musician, which is what you really wanted to do, right? Which is where you are right now. How did you get the band together?
Well, I wrote a song called Wishing Well, and it took me like 8 months. I wrote it, you know, 20 different times, and it was fine. It was the first thing I'd ever written where I was like, oh, this is actually, I should do this. And so I decided to start a rock band.
Standing on a bus stop, feeling your head pop out in the night, in the kind of night where you want to be out on the street, on the street. Crawling up the walls like a cat in heat, and the air is thin and it blows to your skin, and you feel like something is about to begin. But you don't know why.
You obviously were close to your dad. You and your dad used to love to go to Hollywood Park. You mentioned that that's where the men go, right? And he would bet on the horses and you would have your day together. He died 3 weeks before it was torn down to make way for that NFL stadium, Hollywood Park.
Yeah.
So you secretly scattered his ashes on the track somewhere else because you couldn't take it to Hollywood Park. Where did you go?
Yeah, I went to Santa Anita, and this was before all the really problematic stuff came out about Santa Anita. And I went there and I picked up my father's ashes and I smuggled them in, like literally in the small of my back, because I'm pretty sure it's illegal to bring human remains to a racetrack.
I'm sure there's a law about
and
it somewhere,
So I got some food like we always used to, and I sat up there and I had a little talk with him in my head, and then I emptied out the little Pepsi cup, and I cleaned it and dried it off, and then I put his ashes in it. And then I waited till there was a horse race, and they were like, and away they go, you know, and then the horses start running. And I figured that everyone would follow the race as it went to the final straightaway. So that would be the moment when I could do it and not get caught. Cause you can go to jail for this, and I didn't want to get caught. So I waited, cause you have to watch the last 100, you know, the last 100 of a horse race. You have to watch it.
Yeah.
You can't. It's just too exciting. So they went, the horses went by. And right as they did, when all the eyes were off of me, I threw his ashes into the air and onto the track.
His favorite song was Jackson Brown, right? The Pretender?
Yeah, that's
right. Why do you think he liked that song so much?
God, I mean, don't you feel like Jackson Brown's whole career is like the 60s failed and now we're here? Like, like I feel like that's his whole thing. It's like, well, we tried some stuff. It did not go well.
I'm wondering if more modern decades are not doing so well either. So,
yeah, I was going to say, I don't know. Yeah. 2020 would like a word. We might have you beat for real. I'm just sort of like Jackson Brown's a genius, and I'm just sort of saying that as someone who admires him and idolizes him. But yeah, I think he really was really good at capturing that feeling, that sense. I mean, I remember it so well in like 1981. Like it was like the hippies lost, the 60s lost. You know, Reagan was president. The guy who was from the free speech movement in Berkeley that tried to shut it down, that guy's president. They closed all the mental institutions. All the homeless people were on the street. You know, and the cult had, you know, devolved into chaos, and we went to Oregon to hide. And that was the feeling. And I think, you know, it just, his music had this way of capturing that feeling of the failed hopes in dreams of people who really meant well and tried hard, and it just never quite made it.
I can put you on the spot as we wrap up this queue. It's the last question, but I'm wondering if you would do
Let's
this.
Let's do it.
Would you be willing to sing a line or two of it to finish our chat?
Oh, my God.
It'd be a radio exclusive.
All right, here we go. Caught between the longing for love and the struggle for the legal tender, where the sirens sing and the church bells ring and the junk man pounds his fender, where the veterans dream of the fight, fast asleep at the traffic light, and the children solemnly wait for the ice cream vendor. Out into the cool of the evening strolls the pretender. He knows that all his hopes and dreams begin and end there.
Mikel Jolay, lead singer and songwriter of the Airborne Toxic Event, his new memoir and the band's new album are called Hollywood Park. Wow. Thank you, my friend.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Steve. I enjoyed this.
Caught between the longing for love and the struggle for the legal tender, where the sirens sing and the church bells ring and the junk man pounds his fender. Traffic light, and the children solemnly wait for the ice cream vendor. Out into the cool of the evening strolls the pretender.
Onward with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. With the weather really nice, and oh yeah, the holiday, you may have ventured out over Memorial Day weekend, socially distant from others, of course. But the beach or hiking trails aren't the only recreational activities in town at the moment. You can hop on over to Mel's Drive-In for a 50s restaurant ordering experience, or check out a flick at a drive-in movie theater. Or you can cruise around and go see some art. You getting the theme here? It involves your car. Galleries and museums may still be closed, but your automobile will prove valuable for the art experience in coming weeks. And you can see hundreds of artists from all over Greater LA exhibiting their work on their front lawns. Our art insider, Lindsay Preston-Zappas, is editor-in-chief of Carla. That's Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. She drove around to check out some of those art exhibits on the front lawn. Hey, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
You know, we talk about L.A. being a car town, and then we lament about L.A. being a car town with the traffic
yeah.
and then trying to get people onto the metro and all of those things, right? But we're in a
right.
unique time now. You went and tried to find some of these drive-by art exhibitions. Was it easy to find?
Not really, Steve. I mean, some more than others, but take a listen. This is me driving around trying to find one of
okay,
the spots.
So we just passed the address. I think I saw a sign, and so I'm making a U-turn. All right, let's see. Do we see art?
It's on the right here.
So, you know, I'm really used to going to galleries, but with this, you know, you're going to totally new parts of town, and some of the artworks were in alleyways or in random, you know, spots on the street. So it was pretty difficult to find, and you don't totally know what you're looking for. But luckily, they printed signs that say drive-by art, so that really clued me in. Sometimes when I couldn't even find the art, I would see the sign first, and then you kind of have a clue to pull off there and look around.
So you see the signs that say drive-by art. Who's
yeah.
funding this? Who's bringing all this together?
Right. So this is a coordinated effort that's called Drive-by Art, and it was actually organized by an artist named Warren Neidich. And it's separated onto two weekends. So this last weekend was East Side, and they're using Western Avenue as the kind of dividing line between East and West. So that was all the East Side, and then this coming weekend will be all the West Side. But as far as funding, I mean, it's pretty artist-driven, and the artists are installing their own work and taking it down. So I would guess that there's no money really involved. I don't think the artists are really being paid to participate. It's more of a kind of community effort.
I mean, and it probably behooves them, those artists, to want to get their work out there some way, right?
Exactly. And so it's interesting. I've seen other shows like this, too. So there's an artist collective called Durden and Ray, and they put on a show called We Are Here, Here We Are. And it's the same thing. It's about 100 artists that are installed all throughout L.A., and they have a Google map where you can kind of find where all the artists are and follow it around. There's also a gallery called Parker Gallery, and they're in this kind of Tudor-style house near Griffith Park. And they've been doing these two-week-long exhibitions in their front lawn. Since they're in a house, they have the luxury of having this front grass area. And those have been really cool because they're curated sculpture exhibitions and a bit more honed in. I think it's a trend we're going to see more of, Steve, as this goes on longer.
Obviously, they're at their homes, they're in their front yards and things like that. Were the artists themselves at their own exhibits?
It was kind of mixed, you know. Some was just me in an alley, you know, like trying to determine what was the art. But some of the artists were there, and I got to kind of run into them. So there was one artist that I talked to. His name was Chet Glaze, and he had a number of paintings that were hanging on the fence around the Silver Lake Reservoir.
It's kind of weird. I feel like I'm selling blankets, which is fine. I think the environment here is a little more conducive to it being like people there. Earlier there was a ton of joggers,
yeah,
and like nobody even touched it,
right?
Yeah, so he said he was actually taking his paintings down every night and then coming back to install them, so he was kind of posted up there to protect his work from vandalism.
I want you to use your artistic prowess, Lindsay, and tell us, is it the same thing, drive by going to check it out in an alley or on someone's front yard?
I have to say, Steve, it is not. it's not the same. I mean, in theory, it's a great idea. It's a really creative solution to being able to see work in person, which I'm really thankful for. But, you know, from a viewer standpoint, it's really demanding on the viewer. So for me to drive, you know, across town to see one piece of artwork, it's a bit different than how we're used to seeing work. So I was really thankful for a few of the stops that had multiple artists at one location, or Parker Gallery, what they're doing, because you get a little sense of some curation. Because otherwise, there's not a lot of cohesiveness across the hundreds of artworks that are being exhibited. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to a nice curated group show in a museum. How lovely does that sound? When can we go again, Steve?
That day will come, Lindsay. It's just not today. We'll get there, though. Lindsay Preston Zappas, our art insider and editor-in-chief of Carla, Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Let's hear from another helper who's chronicling the safer-at-home time in LA, one snapshot at a time.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy.
Oh, baby, hide.
Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
Robbie Ziegler is a photographer. She's worked with all kinds of high-profile clients, from American Express to Airbnb. When the order to stay safer at home came down, she started a new project, and it's called Making Waves, and that's taking pictures of people in their environs as the quarantine, as it were, continues. And Robbie's with us right now. So why Making Waves?
We're all in this together right now, and when times do get tough, there's two things that we can do. We can either fight the waves or we can ride them. I'm going around and just checking in on everyone by visiting them in their homes and actually just waving at them, just to bring a little bit of light back to the darkness.
Do you, like, call at them if they're in their homes, or maybe they're on a balcony or in an open space where you see them and are like, hey, I'm just taking pictures. I mean, how does that work?
Everyone and anyone. I mean, these are real people. People reach out to me, and by them signing up, I get to come visit them, and it's neighborhood-based. So when I'm in their area, I let them know that I'll be swinging by and we'll do a quick 10-minute shoot. And then after that, a few days pass and I give them a gallery. And by doing this, we're documenting history, giving a little bit of a break within the quarantine. And it's been a great time for everyone. And I've gotten people even say that I'm the first person that they've talked to or seen in weeks that hasn't been a delivery person or someone at the grocery store.
And it's not just pictures that you're exhibiting on your website. It's also stories, right?
You know, being alone is a personal definition, you know, and I'm seeing so many by visiting all these people. I'm also getting to capture their like fur babies and, you know, they can mean so much to us as they are. We have that connection to them and it gives us that bond as well, you know.
If you wanted to get involved with the Making Waves project, how would you go about doing that?
Anyone can actually sign up for this by visiting the website, www.makingwavesproject.com, and there's a sign-up form that they can tell me a little bit about themselves and where they're at.
Robbie Ziegler, thank you so much for talking with us.
Of course, and thank you so much for taking interest in this.
That's going to do it for us today. Got a helper you'd like to nominate? Tell us. Share your thoughts with us at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. And while you're there, by the way, subscribe to the Greater LA podcast. We'd love to see you there. And we'd love to share with you what we do every day on Greater LA. That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, it would not be an exaggeration if I told you that nearly every prisoner at the federal lockup in Lompoc has or has had COVID-19. So how are things going there? We'll tell you. Jenna Cagle, Rebecca Mooney, Sonia Geis, Matt Gillum, Mario Diaz, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Roken, and Christian Bordahl made this show happen today. It was a good one. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears. Find some beauty today and have a great day.